So this is what I'm envisioning for the evening. This is an informal, and you'll pardon the expression, but organic conversation. I'll direct questions at each of you, but you all have mics, and I'd love for you to just jump in with any of your insights, and encourage you to ask each other questions if something comes up for you. And at the end of the conversation, we'll be opening it up to all of you for a Q&A. So let me introduce our wonderful and amazing artists. We have second to the left, Marianne Weil. Marianne learned the ancient tradition of carving and casting bronze using the lost wax process in Italy, where of course it all began. If you haven't been to Marianne's studio, it's quite wonderful to hear her explain this very laborious and meticulous process. Her pieces lovingly reflect a fine balance and tension, as if the bronze is captured mid-movement. Next, we have Bill Morrison. Bill is this gentleman with the hammer. Bill is an experimental filmmaker known for using rare, archival, and often deteriorating footage to produce archaeological, I think romantic, sometimes shocking, and visually striking films. He has collaborated with some of the most celebrated composers of our time, weaving musical scores into historical imagery. Incident, Bill's latest work, is based on footage of a 2018 police shooting in Chicago and has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Short Film. Darlene Sharneko on my left. Darlene creates intricate mixed media work that is influenced by mapping, topographical elements, and complex layered surfaces. Her work explores memory and the human connection with fabricated communities and natural landscapes. Darlene's work reflects her deep connection with our planet and her resolute voice for a more sustainable future. Our next artist is Anne Sherwood Pundit. Anne's body of work explodes with luminous color and broad lyrical strokes. Her expression is an intimate exploration of her personal growth, pulling from vast experiences, her ancestral artistry, and the natural world around her. She incorporates stitching and mixed materials into her pieces, yielding vibrant yet subtle texture, inviting the viewer to look deeper. And last but not least, Alan Wexler. Alan's work explores our daily routines and activities as rituals to be both honored and questioned. His work is playful and scholarly, defiant and reverential. An architect by training, Alan's understanding of space informs his unique perspective while encouraging us to reimagine our own. So let's start. I found a quote from David Lynch, and I thought it was appropriate here. I learned that just beneath the surface, there's another world, and still different worlds as you dig deeper. I knew as a kid, but I couldn't find the proof. It was just a feeling. There is goodness in blue skies and flowers, but another force, a wild pain and decay, also accompanies everything. Let's dig in. Alan.
Yes.
So we're going to start with the lightweight questions.
Okay.
And then kind of move it, you know, yeah, get everybody settled in here. Did you grow up in a creative house?
I wouldn't say creative. My father was a professional photographer, and I always loved making things as a child. I loved tools. I wanted to be a tool man when I grew up. And I always liked tinkering around the house and in the basement. So I was encouraged, but I always thought of myself as a, you know, through high school that I would become a scientist until the very last semester. And I decided maybe I should take an art course because I really liked building things. And I was said, maybe I should study architecture because it allowed me to think about the third dimension and building and using my hands. So I finally took an art course and I really loved it. Those 400 years, I don't think that answered the question.
Yeah.
But we, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it was encouraged my childhood.
Your parents encouraged you.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Anybody else want to answer that question? I know, Anne, you have your grandma encouraged you and mentored you.
Yeah, I think, in contrast, my grandmother was a professional artist. She had studied at the Art Students League in 1913, but moved back to her hometown in Ohio. So when I came, we would come visit her, and she would always be drawing. And she worked as an illustrator professionally from 1928 through 65. So there was, it's taken me a long time to really appreciate that I was introduced to the world of art making, and it was just sort of in the air. It was assumed that it was something that you did, especially, you know, from the sort of maternal side, and this association of home has is significant. I've found over the years for me that instead of going to the academy or to school, like art was just part of the home environment and being with her. And she was very non-judgmental and encouraging for us. So that's maybe, in contrast, it was, you know, in the air for me.
It almost sounds like it created a safe space for you to express yourself.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Is it just on?
I think it's on.
Okay. Yeah, same in a way. My father was an artist, and he was working as a graphic artist and illustrator during the day, and then came home, and I would just see him come alive to do his own art and express himself in ways that my mother sometimes didn't understand, and I would be curious about, because he could draw a bird perfectly, but he loved to also do abstraction, and I would just watch something from an empty canvas become what his world was.
Did he talk to you about that process for him?
Yeah. Mm. He loved to kind of talk about art, and one of the things was just being inspired to see everything with curiosity. He was fascinated by life and everything. So I drew that in, and I knew, okay, that's the job, but this is where it's at. This is where I want to live.
Lucky for you, yeah.
So I grew up with, my mother was a painter. Oh, my aunt was a sculptor, my father's sister.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate to have two very powerful role models in my life that supported and encouraged me. And I go to my aunt's studio where she did stone carving. And my mother, I always say my mother gave me a paintbrush instead of a rattle when I was a child. So I would play in her studio. And so it was very encouraging growing up to continue the creative process. I was very fortunate. Yeah.
I feel like in my household, the arts were really celebrated, but I didn't get the sense that my parents were artists or that I was expected to be an artist. In fact, when it came clear that I wanted to be an artist, they started saying, well, are you sure you want to be an artist? You know? But I would say that it all kind of flipped because myself and two of my three sisters all identify as artists now, and my parents, as they approached retirement, kind of realized, I mean, I think they previously thought we're art appreciators, we're not artists, but seeing what their kids did, they're like, well, maybe we are artists, they must have gotten it from somewhere. And they started taking classes and eventually painting on their own, and really my mom just passed last week, and my most cherished times with her were my wife Lori and I would rent a house with her in Florida every spring, and we would paint, you know, for the last 10 years of her life. We would, if there wasn't a table, we'd go to Walmart and buy a table, and then we'd just paint for 2 weeks. And, you know, I'll miss that this spring. But it really turned. I think they got it from their kids.
It's so interesting to hear all these stories from you, because I think about what a courageous decision it is to make a life as an artist for obvious reasons. But it almost sounds like you all came by it naturally in some ways.
Well, I have to say that there was resistance. I said I can't be an artist. You know, it's following my mother's footsteps. So I resisted and thought about law school and thought about all sorts of alternative possibilities in it. Kept coming back to me.
For me, it wasn't so organic. It's because studying architecture was a more respectable profession amongst, you know, first-generation Jews who came to this country. So I could pursue a field in architecture, but that would be a way of bridging that gap, and it slowly evolved into practice of fine art. Always looking at architecture as the medium that I might explore. But I didn't have that kind of encouragement. However, my family, my father worked 7 days a week, and on the occasion he didn't have a wedding or bar mitzvah to photograph on a weekend, they loved coming to the city and they brought us to museums. So that was really fantastic, and I remember one of the most formative exhibitions I went to see with my parents, might have been at the Guggenheim, was a David Smith sculpture show. And I said, that's what I love. I think I want to be an artist.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. That's good. Well, could you change the, thanks. If you could keep changing them, that would be great. Thanks. So, Anne. This is kind of maybe a little redundant, but did you have any mentors, and what did you learn from them?
Well, I would go back to my grandmother, I think. I've certainly learned from a lot of artists and teachers, but that sense of really believing in me and, you know, sort of accepting me totally, back in that sort of feeling of this non-judgmental, you know, home environment is where I go to when I'm, you know, when I'm working now, you know, I've painted all my life. It's been, you know, 60 years I've, you know, been working, had a studio and pursued my art, but I think just in the last 10 years, I've understood exactly what that feeling is that she gave me, that I can go to that place to trust myself, to make the decisions that I need to. And in, you know, in many cases, I work on unstretched canvas, and some of the ways that I approach my painting are maybe unconventional and aren't by the book, but I know that I can trust myself to follow what I need to do.
Is that true for all of you, that there's a sense of trust, an internal sense of trust which means that you would be willing to let yourself just go where it takes you and trust that? Yeah.
I think one has to, yes. You walk through a doorway and you have to keep walking and trust your intuition will guide you.
Yeah,
I think with any project you set up parameters for how rules for yourself that are going to see you through to the end, and the degree to which you follow those rules is that's your course.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a combination of trust and hesitation, and always questioning whether the work that I'm currently doing is as good as the work I did yesterday. Mm-hmm. So there's always that anxiety built into it. But when you're absorbed in the work, there's nothing better. And it's the point where you're making work, but you forget that you're making it, the work is making you. Mm-hmm. And that's the beautiful place where you are being driven by the work and you're not driving the work. But it sometimes takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah, but that's the sweet spot.
Exactly. But when you're in that, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of meditation.
You can resonate with that. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So, what informs your work? Is it current events? Is it something much more personal? Is it your early life, current emotional life? Do you look inward or outward for your inspiration?
I would say both. The work, again, I loved that this was called Beneath the Surface, because the work is very tactile, and making objects that you can kind of see as three-dimensional wall sculptures, and there are many textures and forms there. But for me, it is writing and asking questions. Mm. And that process is informed, but it's my way of trying to understand what is happening in the world. So there are always letters to the universe. And so I am taking in what is happening, and I'm so thankful to have the practice, because the world is completely overwhelming. Every day before it feels like it's falling apart, it's overwhelming in its beauty sometimes, and it's confusion, and I go to the artwork to ask questions to the universe about what is happening.
With or without judgment?
I'm asking. Mm. So it's more help me to understand, and also the work started out as formal language, but trying to see myself in a place in this village, in this world, moving outward, and then also as part of humanity. Mm-hmm. So as you shift and change, what is happening, where am I within that? Mm-hmm. And then asking that through hammering a nail, sort of as a Morse code letter going outward. Mm-hmm. So every day it's so good to be able to kind of go there. And
Is it finding a safe space for you in that work, literally? You know, when you find a place in your work for you to go to? Is it looking for safety? Is it looking for an answer? Is it looking for where you belong?
It's more, I like to think of us as an organism, so it's almost just being a sensory part of that organism. And if there is something that I am supposed to then communicate out from taking in information, then that's what I want to write out and also do. So sometimes working with the piece gives me an answer into a phone call I need to make, or an email I need to write, or a donation I need to make. Something that is a pulse through the organism based on what I'm feeling, that conglomerate of information coming back through it.
Anybody else want to answer that question? I'm going to just say that, so for Bill, right, I mean, your most recent work, or the one that is up for an award, so that is about a 2018 police shooting in Chicago. Are you part of that? Is it just the current event, or are you inserting your own emotional life into that piece of work?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's somewhat personal in that particular incident, the name of the film is Incident, took place about 2 or 3 miles from where I grew up. And it was reported on by a close family friend. And he's also the producer of the film, Jamie Calvin. He's an award-winning journalist, and he's done a lot of reporting on police oversight in Chicago. And how this film became available to me, I mean, Jamie and I would often stop when I would visit my family in Chicago. I would see him at family events or out on the street. He lived, you know, just a couple blocks down from my mom and dad. And either one of us was running or he was walking his dog, and we'd stop on the street and talk about what he's into. And our careers started overlapping as he became more and more interested in police surveillance footage, specifically with the Laquan McDonald case, which was an enormous case in Chicago, which took place in 2014 and sort of was the precedent for how this film was formed, because this was a case where an officer shot a boy, basically, who was holding a knife and shot him 16 times. And Jamie checked it out and said, well, there should be dashboard camera footage of this. Can we see the dashboard camera footage? And the Chicago police dragged their feet and for 13 months. And then after filing a Freedom of Information suit, which he won, this footage came out. The officer was charged on 6 degrees of first degree murder, which was the first time anything like this had ever happened. And it was all, the feds came in, heads rolled, and basically it was determined that after this, any police incident had to be made accessible to the public within 60 days. So that's the stage that this film was made, in that now anything that the officers record is going to be publicly accessible within a matter of weeks, and the officers sort of know that. You know, they're going around performatively creating a narrative that's going to be their alibi. So to back up, this is a very different project from the type of project I usually do. If you saw, there are the four images, there's these three images of nitrate film decaying and some image by coincidence interacting with that decay. And then there's this, you know, digital image of a street scene in Chicago in 2018 that seems to have nothing to do with the other three, but they all interrogate the archive and they all deal with, how did this image come to us? How are we able to see this image now? What was the history that went behind? What was its history within the archive that made it available to us? And what does that say about our experience? And what does that say about the historicity of the image, about how it progressed through time to reach us? And in most of my films, there was, I mean, you introduced me as an avant-garde or experimental artist, and you know, we saw Decasia here last year, and I think that's a good way of describing that film, but the films I've made in the last dozen or so years have been firmly within the documentary camp, and, you know, image-based, no talking heads to speak of, but nonetheless, they're falling more in that genre than what would be considered experimental or avant-garde. They really interrogate the image and they interrogate the archive, and then from within that, there's also been social issues that have come up. You know, so I was really interested in this project because it offered both. It offered this way of talking about the camera and the awareness, you know, the self-reflexivity of there being a camera, and knowledge that there was an archive out there that was going to be holding these images, and then also how, despite the fact that there was all these cameras, the police were also able to rubber stamp this and say, well, everybody performed their job perfectly, there's nothing to look at here, sure. Behind the fact that they actually murdered a man in cold blood for no reason. And so it allowed me the chance to say, okay, well, let's look at all these images that are publicly accessible and ask the viewer to draw their own conclusions.
So, unlike your earlier work, it sounds like there's an element of looking for some truth to these later works. Is that what inspires you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking for truth in all my work, you know. This happened to have legal truth or social justice truth, but when you're looking at a decaying frame, that is truth, right? That is what happened to that frame, and in some ways you can't help but make the association that that's what's happening to us too, right? And there's some spirit that exists even as this frame is decaying, and I think we're all experiencing that at slower, more rapid rates. And so, you know, I started out by making this analogy between physical media and consciousness, and have followed it through to the work I'm doing today.
Anybody else want to?
Well, I'm kind
did
of.
Did you forget the question?
Yes. No.
Well, I was just going to.
Please.
What was it?
I'm going to remind us. The question was, what informed your work? Was it early emotional life? Was it working out, you know, our angst, whatever it is? Is it current events? Is it inward, outward, a little of both, or a lot of both? What? How's?
Well, it's been interesting to listen to that, the answers to the, you know, I guess two people that have and that what I've heard, I guess, this notion of language and narrative versus the object making or the, you know, the art making. And and I was thinking about my, you know, your question and where I stand with it, and I've come to understand that where I start is in a nonverbal place. Abstraction has to do with, the sort of direct emotional language for me, color and form, that I correlate with. I've made a study of my experience with generational trauma and the realm of secrecy, the role that secrecy plays, where it operates, like the David Lynch quote really gets at this idea that there's, you know, a ghost in the machine, there's something happening below the surface. I think I feel sort of like ghost images in some of the film shots that I saw, in this sense of tuning into what is it that you need to hear, you know, for your pieces, Darlene. So I'm just intrigued by this dichotomy that I think about a lot of this pre-verbal realm. I mean, I see it for all of our work. For me, it is very personal. It's inward and emotion-based. I feel that it extends out and beyond, as I'm sure we all feel our work does, but it comes from that place.
I'd like to segue a bit from Bill's work, because your mention of archaeology in the film, For several decades, I looked at archaeology that informed my work directly. Neolithic sites and climbing into cairns and tombs. But more recently, I've interpreted and digested the archaeology very differently and taken away a very different feeling, and digesting what informed my earlier work has taken decades to inform today's work in a more internal fashion. So a more emotive way, rather than directly taking from what I visually and historically visited and saw.
Do you think that that's the result of getting older? Yeah,
I think it's the beauty of making art for many years is that you have the opportunity to digest experiences from decades or, you know, months, years, decades.
And I also think about getting older. It's certainly been my experience. Getting older, I feel safer, and we've talked about trust before. I feel safer and more trusting of my instincts, and it's resulted in maybe to my children's maybe they're not so happy with this, but less inhibited. I just feel safer in the world, being more authentic.
More authentic, but safer, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think there's so many unknowns when you dive into your work that mm-hmm. that's the risk taking. Mm-hmm. So it may not be safer in that sense.
But don't you think that being more emotive is more trusting?
Yes,
probably
is.
Yeah.
I think what, if we go back to the question, what informs my work, I think it began with my early education in architecture, and I was introduced to people like Andy Warhol and Joseph Beuys as a student, and I hadn't been exposed to the art world beforehand like that, and I said, Andy Warhol, his initials, AW, were the same as mine. I want to become the Andy Warhol of architecture. I thought my role within the field of architecture at that time, I thought of myself as an architect, I don't anymore, but I thought of myself as a person who looks at the softer side of architecture, what in the old days might be called software, now I mean electronic software, but the metaphysical, the spiritual side of architecture. What happens when two people sit at a table across from each other, there's a kind of there's a physicality of the table as both a connection or a bridge, but also as a separation. And that ambiguity is something that's really come to me. Because I studied during the Vietnam War, and I was very active in the anti-war movement. And I think we, as students, felt, could architecture change the world? Could we look, do we have to make more buildings? Could we make proposals that were speculative and theoretical that could have as much effect on the world as building more buildings? So I entered into an area which we called at that time paper architecture or non-architecture or de-architecture, anti-architecture, and we tried to be provocateurs and irritants within the field. And I continue today experimenting with issues that are the other side of architecture. A 2x4 that is made up of flimsy tracing paper that can't support itself, but it kind of supports another aspect, the emotional side, the spiritual and metaphysical side of structure.
So, where were you studying?
I studied at Rhode Island School of Design.
Okay.
And this was in the late 60s, early 70s.
So, that ties in with what John Haydick was doing in Cooper Union at the time.
Yeah, I was familiar with John Haydick's work, but after I had graduated and I started teaching, he was an influence, an important person for me. But there were several mentors at that time who encouraged that attitude that I had at that time and encouraged me, who were more experimental and crossed boundaries between the fine arts and the applied arts.
It's always amazing to me that we're still building war memorials.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Great. Memorials are not a bad thing to think about, because that is a non-functional structure.
I propose building something that teaches peace.
Well, okay. And, Buckminster Fuller point, he said, could we make weaponry into livingry?
Yeah.
And his proposal is to take military vehicles and turn them into Jesus domes. And he was an influence on me, and I got to meet him, and a great influence on me as well.
Yeah.
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 Turn weaponry into livingry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was instrumental in creating the whole Earth catalog, which I'm sure some of us old timers mm-hmm. are familiar with. The spaceship Earth didn't come with an instruction manual.
Yeah.
That was the only problem with it. And I think he said how, and I think that's what the idea of the whole Earth catalog, which then became the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It was an early version of, you know, access to resources on spaceship Earth.
Yeah.
So I was very influenced by those kind of, you know, people.
Sure.
And also, you know, lots of the people. John Cage was a great
one. Bill, how do you quiet self-doubt?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, I guess I have a meditation process that's active. I run, when I'm not injured anyway, I run enormous amounts every week, and that's really where I process a lot of my thinking. It's also when I remember, like you said, the email I gotta send or the thing I gotta do, that all comes out in those. I also have a practice of cold water swimming. I swam today in the ocean.
Wow.
So that's about being comfortable with yourself, facing fear, and then breathing and becoming comfortable. And that's also part of that process. I mean, there is, of course, a lot of anxiety that comes, especially early in your career, about choosing to be an artist. And I'd say, later on, it's more anxiety about getting everything done in the limited time that we have to do it. Luckily, I'm not plagued with as much self-doubt as I was when I was younger. I have a process. I have ideas that I want to get done. I think it's true that the best projects grab us, like you were saying, and that's the real bliss, is to feel like can't wait to wake up to get back to it. A few hours after going to bed, you're just totally immersed in a project. You know what has to be done every day, and that's the real payoff for me. I do have doubts about projects where I'm moving them along, but I haven't reached that kind of bliss state with them. And the question is this a worthy project? Does this go back in the sock hole? Drawer of projects that may come out, or am I waiting for something to drop in my lap, like this footage, where I say, okay, there's a project, I can put everything else aside and go with that. So I guess it's trust that I know when a good one's on the line, and if I'm not super excited about it, well, maybe I need something else that's going to uplifted, or I'm going to see it in a new light.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, I have self-doubt all the time. Every time I start a new series of works, I wonder where it's going to go. And I really don't know until the series is finished. And even then, there's the unknown. And again, we go back to the time factor, and only with time do you understand what was. what came before. You know, you can make sense of the previous work by what you're doing today. So there's a lot of the beginnings are always filled with doubt. It's just the way it is, and we have to live through that, or I have to live through that, and that's the fear factor. You know, you have to walk with that.
So it's and that's you're right. That's where the time comes because you know you have the tools to understand what it takes to move through that self-doubt.
Yes.
Which is accepting the self-doubt.
And I have friends who remind me, they say, you always say that, you don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I come to a point where it does ring true.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I don't really trust feeling confident about something. I think the doubt really for me is like an acquired taste, and it's where the beginning of interesting things, you know, happen for me. Like, if you know, if you're confident, you know, then there's no point in sort of moving forward. It's the kind of sense of questioning and that you know that you need to get to the bottom of the self-doubt. I run toward the doubt. I don't run away from the doubt.
I love that.
I think it's just always a way of working. We're always on that edge between success and failure, and when we're not, it means the work is heavy-handed and it's not very good, and you're too comfortable. So I think there is always that kind of level of doubt, but it's also exciting because you're really trying to work through it. And so it's hard to go to sleep when you're not clear as to what direction the work is going. So you keep working and working, and hopefully something will happen. But you know, it's pure research. We don't know where we're searching. We have the urge to move in a particular direction, but we don't know whether we're gonna fall off that edge. And kill ourselves intellectually.
Yeah.
Maybe physically.
It's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting, but it's also anxiety proof.
Yeah.
With the work, I guess recently, not so recently, but I used to make pieces that were very linear and it was an actual letter format. After I left that, and I would kind of make that was this sort of. And it is written a code, and there's a sequence, and I realized I could condense everything into one now, and that made more sense because this is a repetition of that same thought or question. And so when that happened, then I was able to open it up and let the piece sort of emerge. And there was a bit of nervousness with that because I was very structured before. But this way, I just sat down, began again, and I let the piece sort of dictate where it wanted to go. And that now the pieces tell me stories. And it's really, I feel like when it's a successful piece is when I didn't know what it was going to say. And at the end, I'm starting to understand it. And I'm taking it in. And so each time that I sit down, it's this idea of, okay, I'm not supposed to know right now. My job is to start again, begin again, hammer the first nail again today. It's a new day at this person in this world, the way it is right now, and see where it goes, and then let it go.
It kind of reminds me of a relationship. You know, there's an acceptance, a healthy relationship, right? You don't really know what the other person is going to think or say, or maybe sometimes you can guess because you know them well, but in a healthy relationship like those you have with your work, it's about respecting and honoring that person or that piece of work and how it evolves. Yeah. Okay.
So, took your glasses off.
But you saw it beforehand, so this isn't a surprise. What has your work taught you about love, and fear?
Well, I think we just talked about fear. You know, the fear of taking the risks, and it's a daily trial about taking those risks in the studio and making mistakes. It's life, and about love. I mean, I love my work. I don't know what I would do. I think one of your questions, what would we do if we weren't artists? But I love what I do, and so it brings me back to the studio every day. The fear factor is about how I approach the work and not knowing. It's always the unknown, because I don't, unlike many artists or sculptors, they'll have a sketch and follow up on that sketch. I really work more from my gut and trust my intuition, and I build and construct based on previous work. So that they have a dialogue, and I'll be working on a series, maybe 5 or 6 sculptures at the same time. And they'll culminate more or less at the same point. But they have to speak to me, you know, there's a conversation, and speak amongst themselves. It's very challenging, because sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes, you know, I'll go months and I have to walk away from those pieces, start a new series, and then come back, and then I'll say, it's a kind of an aha moment that things will click and they'll start to mesh and speak
That's
to me, so speak to themselves. Yeah.
I didn't realize that you worked a number of pieces
simultaneously. I always have, yeah. And that's how, I think that's what inspires me, it keeps me going. So today when I was in the studio, there were 3 different pieces. I was going back and forth, welding 3 different works. And they'll probably come together at the same time too, and be more solid for that. But for weeks, they're floundering, as I am floundering, with, you know, trying to struggle with what is...